This is CliffCentral.com.
Let's get into it, folks. We've been waiting for this for, I feel like I've been waiting for it the whole week, really, to get into the burning platform.
Really?
Yeah, I'm hoping for some constructive conversation this morning. I'm hoping to just sit back and learn as well, because with everything going on this week, I feel like I speak on behalf of many other people who go, well, I don't even know what to think. So I'm just going to pick your brains this morning to learn more. So this is the Burning Platform on cliffcentral.com without Gareth this morning, but the rest of the team are here to take care of everything. If you do want to add to the conversation, you can by texting us on 079-748-2090. And we have a special contributor this morning, someone who came with great recommendation from Ulysses Pumi. Do you want to do the introduction? Why did you feel like we had to get at Mighty Jamie in this morning?
Well, because I'm very fascinated by the thoughts that he puts out on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But also, I think today, I'm glad you're here today because, you know, we went to bed last night with the news that Nigeria has recalled their ambassador from South Africa. Which is a big thing in diplomatic circles, you know, and South Africa, you know how I feel about xenophobia in this country. And right now, the chickens have come home to roost. People last year were campaigning on the back of foreigners, this and this and this. And now it's almost like people have forgotten.
Guys,
you know?
It's last week. When did Makura put out that statement?
Yeah, so Makura's statement last week. But I mean, even Cyril Ramaphosa, we've got videos of the man blaming our economic woes on Africans. And I keep saying that the thing about xenophobia is when people are disenfranchised, mm-hmm. when people are feeling the way that they feel in this country and on the ground, they look, and when you are weak and you are already the downtrodden, you look for the person that is weaker than you to exert your power on. And what we are seeing yesterday, so a couple of days ago, we see last week it was, Catherine, as you said, our capital city is on fire. This week it is our economic capital that is on fire. And it's all xenophobia. Mm. It is foreigners being attacked. It is stores being looted. It is, and it's insane. And then what we've started seeing this week, if we are seeing the African backlash. We're seeing the African backlash, Zambia versus Bafana Bafana, right? Game cancelled. Zambia's like, we're not playing with you people. But then the videos that we started seeing yesterday afternoon and in the evening is Nigerians looting South African stores in Nigeria, breaking down ShopRite, MTN, one of our biggest retailers in this country, makes their money. The reason why they have been able to withstand the economic malaise that this country is in is because they make their money outside of South Africa. Mm. And that money gets spent back here, right? So, and the African Free Trade Agreement is, we are being isolated. South Africa is now being isolated by the rest of the African economy. With the economy that we have here, we have nowhere to grow if Africans do not want to do business with us. That's the effects of xenophobia. Yeah. That's what it looks like. And it directly affects all our pockets. And, you know, so...
So,
and Jamie's been tweeting a lot.
That is why we're so glad to have you in this morning. So thank you so much for coming through.
It's
we really
pleasure.
Do want to get to find out more about what you think. Because as well, when Sis Pumi recommended you, I started scrolling through your timeline. And I thought, there's a lot to get into there. But you are a law graduate from the University of Wits. You're currently furthering your studies at Wits Business School. You're a critical thinking and communications instructor at AfroSpeak, which is a Joburg-based education and communications company. And in the midst of so much more, you're also a great person to chat to this morning. So let's get right into it. Yeah, what are your thoughts on what is currently transpiring in the city?
So, you know, for me, just watching the African moment, we've been having a good moment. And, you know, if you use hip-hop as a metaphor,
okay,
the first thing that you actually create is you create a community a community that enjoys stuff together, that creates fashion, music, lingo, and all of that creates an economy. So you've got Jay-Z, Beyonce, Dr. Dre, Puff Daddy. Between the four of them, they are worth well over $2.5 billion. So they created an economy from a community. Mm-hmm. So before the incidents of last week, what were we witnessing? We were witnessing Africa coming together. You know, you've got Burna Boy, who's getting a global look. You've got Beyonce putting an Afrobeat album out. You've got Jidenna taking a delegation of people to Ghana, saying, let's go to Ghana and have a great moment. He went with Swizz Beatz and other Americans. And America, unfortunately, is an endorser of global culture. If Hollywood doesn't think you're cool, people don't want to visit. You know, so we were now having this collaborative moment where you've got Shoma Jozi, Burna Boy, you've got all of these big African names all getting a look at the same time. You've got Nom Zamo getting a role, major role in the film. I can't remember which one it is right
coming
now.
Coming to America.
Coming to America. Yeah. So South Africa and Nigeria were benefiting the most from the spoils of the African moment, be it cinematic, be it music-wise. And I use this to refer to the fact that for African trade to work, we need to have a common identity and a commonality of values, et cetera, et cetera. And we do have a commonality of values, that being Ubuntu. What's always been a struggle is the commonality of identity around culture. Mm. And why has it been a struggle? Because traveling is expensive, because most of South Africa lives in poverty. So while some are very either forced out by poverty, Africans from their home states have traveled and seen Africa and developed a global perspective, or people like Shoma Jozi, who are just adventurous and went into Africa and developed a Pan-African perspective. Most South Africans are, because of the economy, isolated from the rest of Africa, because it's not so easy to just say, let me go and see Tanzania. You know, that's a 5,000 rand flight one way, right? So if you're already struggling with economic difficulties here, you're not necessarily going to go to Addis Ababa. You're not necessarily going to go to Dar es Salaam. You're not necessarily going to go even further. We're talking Lagos, we're talking Accra here. Those costs are quite prohibitive. Mm. So when all of this happens, it's really put a dent. And I was I was pulling my hair when the celebrities got involved in this, because they lack political nuance, right? So now you've got YC coming in, and he may necessarily have his own argument with, AKA, et cetera, et cetera. So now they amplify, because all of these celebrities, unfortunately, they are the biggest voices in Africa because of their platforms on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So if you look at somebody like Burna Boy, he has 1.7 million followers on Twitter. Right? So when he tweets, right, even if it's mildly divisive, it escalates the animosity which already exists in the Nigerian community, because they view him as a leader because of the virtue of his success. So now, coming back to the situation on the ground in South Africa, watching the rhetoric that started, I think I'll put it at Herman Mashaba's door, because he's the one who started playing with this narrative. Because, and this is what Herman Mashaba started saying from years ago, 3 years now, I think he's been beating this drum. And you know what they say, you repeat a lie often enough, for some people it becomes the truth. Oof. He started saying that, look, these foreigners are illegal. These foreigners are doing crime, and I don't want criminals in my city. And these foreign businesses are not registered, right? And these people, he then adds this new label that Makura co-signed. They're selling counterfeit goods, an undefined word, because who is actually complaining about the counterfeit good? If there is a Chinese sneaker called, let's call it Kli Sports, mm-hmm. right? The Kli Sports sneaker, it's selling in China Mall. Is it a counterfeit good? If there's a Zambian national who's selling it in Brie? So if you come and you say, these are counterfeit goods, you're selling, I bought them legally from China Mall. I bought them legally from China Mall. When did they become fake? When did they become counterfeit? In what process? Because you allowed them to come in a Chinese ship to the ports in Durban and Port Elizabeth. You signed off these goods. They went through your customs. And then you said, you are allowed to go sell these in bulk at China Mall. So now I'm an informal trader. I go to China Mall and I say, young people like sneakers. They like, what do you call these things? Fanny packs, which, by the way, are mostly not branded. So now I'm selling my fanny packs, earphones, and sneakers in the CBD. You come and you say, I am illegal and my goods are counterfeit. What's counterfeit about them? Did Adidas complain? that Abibas was being sold in the streets of the CBD. They don't care about that. Louis Vuitton doesn't care that there are fake Louis Vuitton bags being sold in Africa. In fact, they like the fact that people aspire to their stuff, right? That's why we don't have an issue around this kind of stuff. So now, Herman Mashaba then comes and says, these are illegal people selling illegal things. And not only that, the ones who are not selling illegal things are selling drugs and they're sex trafficking. And
lumping everyone into one thing.
And here's the unfortunate part. Most people who are in trade, because they're highly visible, they're visible people, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people who maybe don't have documentation are working as your maid in Sandton, right? They are in hiding. They don't want to be in public because they don't have paperwork. And you knew that when you hired them as a maid. Most of us listening know exactly what I'm talking about. You have a Zimbabwean maid, a Zimbabwean gardener, a Zambian maid or a Zambian cook, etc., etc. They are undocumented, right? They came through here because they were running away from extreme oppression. It's not like people just come for vacation, by the way. They're running away from extreme oppression, dictatorial leaders who are targeting them or their families. Some of them are running away from rape, communal victimization because they are gay, they are queer, and the communities where they come from want to kill them for those identities. So they just come into the country and they smuggle. But our refugee laws don't make provision for someone who's running away from their village because they are gay. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The international law, you need to have a certain status where your reasonable fear of persecution needs to be provable at a political level. But how do you like prove that your uncle wants to kill you because you're gay? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You still have a reasonable fear of persecution and discrimination and being beat up, but you can't necessarily prove that to an immigration reception officer. So you just come. You're trying to survive. Now, the people who are trading are not the undocumented type of people, actually. There are people in South Africa who have different statuses, and it's important to explain. This is from the Refugee Act. You have either someone who's seeking asylum. That means they haven't been processed yet. There's a pending decision. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of South Africans who are just seeking asylum. Do you understand what I'm saying? The Refugee Reception Office has got notoriously bad administration and they're very slow and it sometimes takes years. I used to work at the Refugee Office at the Wits Law Clinic, you know, for my final year. Someone will be on asylum seeker status for 10 years. You know, they ran away from Kabila and they're still considered an asylum seeker to this day. Not everyone is given refugee status because of the inefficiencies. But guess what? Even as an asylum seeker, you're allowed to work to trade. Right? So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got people who are given refugee status. That means they can legally reside in South Africa as refugees because they've been deemed to have a reasonable fear of persecution in their or death in their home country. Do you understand what I'm saying? There's hundreds of thousands of people with that status. Then further than that, you've got people who are given group refugee status. When there is a mass moment where people move into a country in a large number, they are given refugee status if the reasons why they moved are deemed to be credible. So you had a massive influx of Zimbabweans, you know, as a result of the Mugabe military dictatorship, where people were being killed, tortured, abducted, where political expression was being suffocated, and there was massive intimidation. All of these are reasonable grounds for persecution. Canada, the UK, many other countries have given people refugee status from the Mugabe regime era. So what does Malusi Gigaba and the ANC decide to do? Because they don't want to push Mugabe out. They don't want to be seen to be effecting regime change in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They grant what is a special dispensation to over 500,000 Zimbabweans. They say if you're in South Africa...
But I need to climb in at this point because that was an opportunity to loot very specifically because that special dispensation, the Zimbabweans pay for it.
Mm. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So I mean... The amount of, and remember that money was channeled through the Guptas because they had the contract to actually administer those permits.
And that may very well be the case, right?
It is the case.
No, I'm not contesting the financial side of it. I'm talking about the narrative that these people are undocumented, they're illegal. So they are given the status, right? The 500,000 of them. And it's extended, by the way, even after Mnangagwa comes into power. So these are people who are allowed to work, to trade. Do you understand what I'm saying? They're the kind of people where if a policeman comes and says, why are you selling shoes here? He can say, here's my special dispensation permit that allows me to work and trade. Mashaba knows this. He knows that most of the people who are in high visibility areas have the paperwork. But he still comes to the people of Gauteng and tells them that these people are illegal and they're selling illegal goods. And by the way, right, the Nigerian consulate has denied that the person who killed the taxi driver was actually a Nigerian national. And even the Sowetan, when they reported on this story at the beginning, they could not confirm that the person who killed the taxi driver was actually a Nigerian. And the people who were there, the taxi drivers themselves were there, said, we found the police working with community people selling nyaupe, and we confronted the police, and there was an ensuing shootout, and that's when that taxi driver died. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Flared up in Pretoria and created the main...
So all of this, last week. There's been...
What was the excuse, yes.
Exactly. So there's been a rhetoric that has come from the political leadership in Gauteng, which has exacerbated a stereotype. And that stereotype has been extended to nationalities, that Nigerians are a problem in our country. They're doing drugs, they're trafficking women, and all of these foreigners, in fact, are problems because, one, they don't even have paperwork and they are giving us counterfeit goods. What does that create in communities which already have challenges with violence? Nobody needs to be told that South Africa is notoriously violent. We're still dealing with the vestiges of letting guns into our communities, letting people rob banks to finance the ANC for struggle purposes, and then not giving them adequate employment post the fact. This is where all of this violence starts and comes from. Add some patriarchy to that, add some nationalist pride, add some history of other rising other tribes. You have a very bad mix there, right? So now all of that comes into the fray, and we are beginning to see a disintegration of the cultural unity that we need for economic prosperity in Africa. Because it's not just a South African thing, this African free trade area. The market is currently 1 billion people, and it's potentially going to grow to 2.4 billion by 2050. Mm-hmm. So now you tell me, in the week that you're having your World Economic Forum, how can you afford to divide the continent culturally? Because the people who are going to be going looking for deals in Rwanda, in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, are going to be small to medium-sized businesses. It's not just going to be pick and pay. So now you are a small business. Maybe you're a coder, right? Maybe you like listening to Cliff Central on 7 a.m. in the morning. Now you want to go and do a coding deal for Rwandan businesses, and all of them are like, wait a minute, but your people just killed me. Your people just actually told me that I'm toxic. Your people told me that I'm illegal. And now you are in my country. Even though the paperwork allows you, you want to make a profit in Rwanda?
How do you expect this to all play out?
Look, unfortunately, it has all played out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm saying? It has all played out. All of the rhetoric we had in the last 5 days, unfortunately, was escalating. All of the people who had opportunities to de-escalate, escalated.
Canton, what about you? How do you expect things to roll out over the next couple of days?
Look, I think this whole idea of having any sort of unity across the continent is rubbish. We've never had it. We are never going to have it. But no one in the world has it. I mean, we can't even get Chiefs and Pirates supporters to sit in the same stadium without wanting to rip each other's throats out. I mean, this whole idea of unity across the continent is never going to work. But ultimately, what happens is that as soon as you have prosperity, then inevitably it becomes contagious. And it really has to start with actually fixing our economy. At the point at which we actually have a government that knows how to run the country properly, it then actually opens up for the rest of the subcontinent to actually benefit. And the effect becomes very quickly contagious. The reason why we have people flocking to South Africa is because, in as much as we know that the way in which our ANC has run this country has turned this into a shithole, it's still a cleaner shithole than everything north of the Limpopo, apart from Botswana. But Botswana is an exception. We'll, park that aside.
They have
but
more cows than people.
That's not the point. It goes back to the essence of good governance in Botswana, which actually means that it works reasonably well. It's the reason why Mauritius does well. Rwanda actually has good governance, even though it's an extremely repressive place, and I would not want to be living out there. But fundamentally, if you get us back to the situation where you're able to unleash the economy, and then we're able to properly accommodate people who are coming into the country. And at some point, we need to segue into the stuff that Tito was talking about, because one of the things that he speaks about is the question of opening up skilled migration. And I'm a huge fan of
but this ties in. So to put two things, just to push back a little bit, is I don't actually think that any identity is a realistic identity. You just need to get a critical mass of people to pretend like it's a thing, right? So, because all identities are fiction.
No, it's absolutely right. You get, so the Rainbow Nation worked for us because we had a critical mass of people who bought into it. Yeah. But it's a fragile construct, because until you have that critical mass of people who buy into it, it's not going to work, no matter how well-intentioned it is.
Yeah, but I think we should work towards it because of the economic conditions Africa has. So, for instance, the Zulu identity is a coerced identity through Shaka, right? It was a set of disparate tribes which all were pursuing their own individual identities. Zulu was one of the tribes. It was a smaller one, but because of Shaka's military tactics, he was able to consolidate everyone into this blanket umbrella, which wins long enough for people to then say, I'm no longer that thing. I am now fully Zulu, right? But you understand that it's a merger almost under a visionary, mm-hmm. right? Bismarck unified Germany because Germany also was facing the same challenges of disparate groups working in different directions. So the concept of unifying people under a meta identity is one that is useful, and it could actually work in Africa because there is, even though it's vague, there is a general consensus that we have this unitary value system of Ubuntu. So it's something that can be populated with more specifics. But further than that, there is a shared oppression, and shared oppressions can unite. Now, when it comes to the Tito Mboweni ideas, and this is where, even if you don't care about the Pan-African project, which I do think is a worthwhile project, is even if you just care about the pure economics, having people buy into the narrative helps your outcomes. For instance, we all know that South Africa has 80% of our grade fours, they cannot read and they cannot do maths, right? We're talking about the grade fours who are in the public education system. This is status quo. We know that we need radical interventions to fix our education. We know that the NDP envisions getting teachers from outside in the short to medium term to teach in those communities. So we're saying we need international teachers to go teach in townships. Most of those international teachers are realistically going to come from Africa, because those teachers will opt out of their own economies because of everything you said about poor governance and the real poverty.
Like Zimbabwean teachers.
We have Zimbabwean teachers working here as Uber drivers.
Yes, exactly. And some of the challenges we're facing now, right, is that because of the xenophobia, even if you do make a more progressive visa regime for the teachers now, you're going to bump into the sentiment that has been created by Mashaba and others, and this is Indunas in the hostels, where they are now saying, we don't want these people, they're stealing our jobs, even though we already know that we have a shortage. Because I always tell people this, they say there's no shortage of teachers, right? But if one teacher is teaching 50 students, that's a shortage, because one teacher is supposed to be teaching 25 students. So what we are saying is we need double the number of teachers we have now. And then people will then say, we can't afford it because, where we go, how are we going to pay all of these teachers? And then in response to that, I say, can we actually afford to not teach? Yeah. Can we afford to have 80% of our students unable to read? Mm. What does that create as a social burden? It means that we're saying that these are unemployable people, and we are already acknowledging that the next economy that is coming into effect is a high skills economy, where if you don't have the skills, you're out.
You're already left behind.
So then what happens? What happens when you've created the resentment? So if Tito wants to bring in talent, unless you're getting it from Europe, because we accept European talent, right? It doesn't go through the same scrutiny that African talent does. It doesn't have the same animosity attached to it. Then the economic project failed. Everything you said earlier about the only way South Africa can expand its manufacturing because of our competitive advantage and our sophisticated economy in comparison is to export to the rest of Africa, which we're already doing. That's why Cyril Ramaphosa spent some time going to Tanzania earlier before the conference to discuss trade deals, because South Africa is, our trade balance with Tanzania is in our favor. Our trade balance with most African countries is in our favor. Mm. We can make the stuff that they can make because they are failed economies or more failed than we are. And we've jeopardized all of that. We could have been the Germany of Africa now, but now we've given that opportunity to second movers like Rwanda, like Tanzania, who also want to be the South Africa of Africa. But now, because we failed to provide political leadership, when you are the economic hegemon, yeah, you cannot hate immigrants from your region.
Well, let's get into it, because then it speaks to what was released last week. The National Treasury released their discussion document, which was titled Economic Transformation, Inclusive Growth and Competitiveness. This is towards an economic strategy for South Africa. Camden, you call this Project Tito?
I call it Project Tito because it's just a, you know, it's a shorter phrase to describe it than going through the entire...
Because I mean, that whole title just rolls out the tongue, doesn't it?
Inclusive growth and competitive. No, let's just call it Project
Read the
Tito.
77 pages and then you'll know.
Yeah.
It's Project Everywhere.
Well, I've read through those 77 because, you know, last week we touched upon it very briefly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tend to get very reluctant to comment.
What did you think about it?
Well... For the first time in a long time, and I think the words I use something like it's the first sign of something intelligent that's emerged from the ANC since the time that Zuma was deposed. Mm. Really, it's the first thing that they've said that has actually made me sit up and say, "No, hang on a second, you know, there's still people behind the scenes who are actually doing stuff that's kind of vaguely
constructive
and intelligent, and more importantly, that we can actually sell to the rest of the world as something that shows that we are serious about wanting to put this country back on track. Now, is it a coincidence that he released it just shortly before the World Economic Forum was going to happen? Well, I don't know. Maybe it was good planning, but even so, whatever the motivation you want to read into it. Look, let's just talk about some of the things that he's talking about. He says lowering barriers to entry and addressing distorted patterns of ownership. I think we can all agree on that. Prioritizing labor-intensive growth, agriculture and services. Again, I think we can all agree. Implementing focused and flexible industrial and trade policy to promote competitiveness and facilitate long-run growth. Again, I think we can all agree. And promoting export competitiveness and regional growth opportunities. He then goes down into a bunch of specifics. And here's a couple of things that kind of stood out for me. And they might seem like very stupid things, but when you actually add them together, they make real differences in the lives of people. So one of the things that he said was, you break up Metro Rail and you hand it to the municipalities. Now, this for me is such a no-brainer. Hmm. Okay, because the whole idea that you should be able to use Metro Rail as part of an integrated transport system that's local to your metro is something that should be so obvious. You should be able to have seamless transport like you do in most countries. If you go to London, for example, you end up with this thing, it's called an Oyster card.
Yeah.
Which you can use on any form of transport. You hop onto a bus, you tag your Oyster card. Hop onto the underground, you use your Oyster card. Hop onto regional rail, you use your Oyster card. And Metro Rail right now is an absolute disaster because of the fact that it's run by PRASA at national government level, has no interest whatsoever in the spatial development goals of cities. So right now we should be looking at things like, firstly, you design transport hubs that involve rail, that involve your minibus taxis, that involve your buses. And that has to be part of your urban planning system because that will then affect how you plan for where you put up your low-cost housing because people are then able to make use of the transport infrastructure in a relatively seamless way to get back and forth. So then he said, Transnet should become a rail infrastructure provider, but private companies should have access to their networks. Again,
what does that mean?
Well, what that means, for example, is that let's say I want to set up a company that's being a tourist operator that's going to do all of the historic battle sites for the Boer War and for the Anglo-Zulu War.
Okay.
And there's a huge market for it. Of history buffs who want to come out here. And just imagine, you're able to get on a train in Durban and you're able to visit all of these sites because the rail networks are there. They're not being used. You literally have these railway lines that are going to all of these small villages all over the place. Mm-hmm. But right now, no one is running any rail on it. And if you can just say, Transnet has to make this available, you can immediately create tourism opportunities that spring up from that. You might want to do things like having a high-speed luxury train that goes from Durban to Johannesburg and back. Mm.
That goes to, where were you, Timba?
That plays 4 hours out of town. Well, just quickly.
Yeah, but a luxury rail, like a Rover's rail that goes out into the Kruger or whatever.
Okay, but let's just go back to Tito. Then he talks about he wants to sell the power stations like Medupi and Kusile. And he's absolutely right, because, you know, this is the stuff that we've spoken about in terms of advances in solar technology. You've got Elon Musk now saying that we can produce a gigawatt hour of electricity from about 1.2 hectares of land. A gigawatt hour of electricity from 1.2 hectares of land. Just, you know, let that sink in terms of what it means. And how we're never going to get
sort of impact it would make.
Yes, and we're never going to get the money back from Medupi and Kusile because, you know, they're bespoke power stations. So sell the guys off. But, you know, we can talk about this. He wants the structures of fuel to change. Again, using Sasol as an example. Sasol is a South African company, and we are producing fuel from coal. Now, the price that we charge per liter of Sasol fuel is based on the international oil price. So Sasol rakes in these huge profits, even though the costs are actually rand denominated in terms of the input costs of the coal, plus the cost of production, because these facilities were built during the apartheid era. So doesn't benefit the people of
the country. Can I jump in a bit? Because I think you've given it a good look, which is, I think, so I want to... There's a South African phenomenon where we lower the bar way too much, and I'll tell you why I'm saying this. The document that Tito Mboweni brought up, which is supposed to be this plan, I think you're correctly calling it a discussion document, right? It's very vague on specifics. There are some high level specifics which have been discussed in other platforms. So when he references it, some people are like, oh, maybe that's the full detailed document from such and such a previous document. But if you go and look at some of the stuff, you won't be provided with the level of detail that makes you think that this is actually something that is doable in a short to medium time frame. So I'm going to give you some examples about that. So one of the I think, relatively palatable sides of the argument is that, hey, let's open up spectrum for the teleproviders to be able to have more spectrum to provide data, 4G as well as 5G in the future, right? And the way you do that is by removing some of the TV channels and using these set-top boxes to receive the signal. That's what he says is an idea. This thing has failed to launch within the ANC for almost a decade now, right? Every time the ANC speaks on this, they're like, yeah, we want to do this thing. We want to get the boxes. We want to do the et cetera, et cetera. So now you come and you say, hey, why don't we just do this thing? It's an idea that has been there in the ecosystem. And you're saying, oh, we can just do it. We can just pull it off without actually being more honest about how actually difficult it is to drive across that legislative, let's call it the rugby ball, right? It's difficult to get it across the try line. And many people have tried and failed to do it over 10 years. You know, so when you then begin to examine the document...
I'll pick up on that particular point.
Yeah. So when you begin to examine the document, so that's level one of... Some of the stuff he's talking about is legislatively difficult to roll out, considering the fact that the ANC votes on a party whip, right? And that party whip comes from the NEC. So if there is no consensus on the vote, he's not going to get the majority he needs to pass it, as well as you won't get the EFF support. So it's difficult to see how the legislation itself will see the light of day. But on the other end of that, there's a dangerous premise, and you know, in America, we're beginning to see some trends which undercut the premise. The premise is that if you give the big four all of the spectrum that they need, the data prices will go down. And sometimes they don't go down because those guys don't have an incentive to compete, because guess what? It's an oligopoly, right? You need to have a closer to perfect competition for prices to go down. So there's been some documentation of this recently. I can't remember the name of the state right now, top of my head. Okay. But there was a state in America which had such high prices that when the state itself started providing broadband, then the service provider started to compete with the state and the prices went down. But only when the state got involved as the broadband provider. So Tito's plan doesn't actually envision any involvement by the state, even as a competitor, right? So if you have an oligopoly, because we only have four telecoms providers in South Africa, they don't have to necessarily compete. And in South Africa, we've seen that we have a cartel economy where the big four of any industry are like, sure, don't worry, cement costs this much.
Yeah, they all
no,
just
I actually
talk
need to
each
climb
other,
in on that very specific point, because we on the telecoms thing, we've kind of gone down this particular rabbit hole. So let me just address a couple of things. Firstly, one of the points that the paper does make is the need for competent national regulators, which effectively is the state oversight over the finite public resources. And the finite public resources in this case is spectrum. So the point that he makes is that when you had ICASA doing its job competently, it meant that things like the interconnect fees were effectively reduced to the point where you had a real impact on the costs that went down to consumers. So this is not something that's going to create the sort of scenario where we're just simply handing spectrum over. Secondly, the point that it's making is that when you free up spectrum, the spectrum then becomes released on an auction basis.
Potentially, right?
Yes, potentially, which has two impacts. First thing it does is that it raises money for the fiscus, which is desperately needed. But then when you have the competent regulator who's actually ensuring that you're reaching down to levels of penetration. One of the ways in which one could get around this, for example, and he speaks about this specifically in terms of local loop unbundling, which is basically the monopoly that Telkom has had in terms of the copper cables that go through directly to people's homes. Now, if I use the Philippines as a very specific example, what they did in the Philippines was they said anyone can have a telecommunications license. On condition, as a direct result of your getting this telecommunications license, in the areas where you get to operate, you have to roll out very basic levels of telephonic service free of charge to every single household within this area.
But I don't think that the companies we have in South Africa have appetite for that. You see,
no, it's not a question of appetite, because you make it a condition of the license. So in other words, you say, yes, you can have the license to do this, but you do need, at very least, to be able to provide the ability for people to have access to spectrum to make emergency calls. So in other words, they need to be able to call for an ambulance. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to call for police. They need to be able to call for the fire department, which is ensuring that you're rolling out the minimum level of infrastructure. Thereafter, if you want to be using WhatsApp and so forth.
I agree with you, right? I agree with you that that's a good model. My concern, and this is, I think, insufficiently addressed, this is why I say the document suffers from a lack of detail, and it mostly suggests, right? So everyone looks at the document and gets from it what they particularly want. So the unions get from it the worst version, and, you know, the pro-capital guys get from it the best version of a competitive economy. But when I look at the South African situation now, the arguments that are used by the big four sometimes as to why the cost of data doesn't go down are disingenuous. Like things, I think even your party was referencing at some point that we can't have data not roll over. Right. But for as long as possible, the telecoms companies didn't allow for data to roll over. And then what did they do now? They kept the data prices very high, and then they started offering these very, very small bundles, which still don't roll over. So they're like, oh, you can have a gig for 80 rands, but it's for 7 days. Right. So you still.
But that's a failure on the part of ICASA.
No, but
again, ICASA has been asset stripped in terms of intellectual capital.
And that's part of the failure, is that it's not just like ICASA, because the public has supported ICASA, right? And we've tried to get ICASA well-resourced. You know, they've got all of these petitions that people have signed, marches that people have gone on. Mm. But corporates have lobby influence as well. And they've slowed down some of the rollouts because they have a big voice and they can sometimes massage the politics of a situation as long as possible. And the thing is, I never confer benevolence onto corporates, because some guys are really out there to, you know, move fast and break things, like Mark Zuckerberg. So if you remember the tobacco lobby, they did the most that they could to prevent the banning of the advertisements. Same as the alcohol companies right now, they're fighting tooth and nail. You know, when we're trying to do the sugar tax, which can contribute to the fiscus, can curb some bad behavior, introduce better drinks into the society, the sugar beverages companies were fighting it tooth and nail. You know, they were getting ads, etc., etc. So my point is just that I think the document needs more flesh before we should give it that it's a good document thing. And I think that the challenge, and this is where the criticism came from. You can respond just now. The criticism was, this is a it's a mashup of ideas that the people Tito commissioned to do the document came up with. So I actually felt like it suffers from a lack of focus, because if he had come and said, here are the three big ideas that I think are going, because now he's got a few pages on transport. He's got a few pages on telecommunications, you know, all of the network industries. Then he's got a few pages on education. But then when you go to the pages on education and you're like, where are the specifics that deal with the historic challenges that you faced at getting the solution that is already in the NDP, which is a 2012 document. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so again, you know, we're going into this, it's lacking in detail kind of stuff. I think that the level of detail is sufficient. And mm-hmm. and again, when you talk about the historic challenges that have been faced, the historic challenges were historic challenges. They are not the same as today's challenges. So if you take the case of Eskom, for example, and I wrote about this last week, where I was talking about the Grand Inga project up in the Congo, which if 10 years ago they had built that hydroelectric project and it had started flowing electricity, it would today have been relevant. Now that project is never going to fly, simply because the cost of building these massive hydroelectric dam projects have been overtaken by technology. Mm. Ditto in the case of education. We can't be saying we need to fix the historical imbalances. The business model has changed completely.
It's
the
true, new though, business but you, model. You still need the foreign talent, right? So some of
not
the stuff
not necessarily
to teach. You're going to need people on the ground.
Not necessarily.
What are you going to do now without the detail? That you see, what I'm saying is,
and
what is the saying? The devil.
No,
the devil is in the detail.
No, and the detail is what he's provided. So let's
he
take
hasn't given
let's
any
take
detail.
Spectrum as a yeah. very particular example. The reason why Spectrum wasn't rolled out was because there was this constant battle behind the scenes, which was funded by the likes of MultiChoice. Because remember, what they wanted was to not have encryption on the set-top boxes. Mm. Why did they not want encryption on the set-top boxes? To perpetuate the monopoly that DStv has on pay television. Mm. Because immediately when you have encryption, you can have pay television. And because of the fact that money changed hands with the Guptas being involved and the SABC being involved, you had a scenario where the set-top boxes, digital terrestrial, was not rolled out.
Mm.
Now, the idea of the necessity to roll out digital terrestrial goes away. The reason why it goes away is because digital terrestrial has been overtaken by events.
Sure.
The events it's been overtaken by is that now you actually have IP-based television, so you have the likes of Netflix and so forth.
Absolutely.
And the idea of using set-top boxes for digital terrestrial now falls away completely. The way in which you can implement the system almost immediately is to actually buy into the OpenView HD model, which ETV already has in place.
Mm.
And all you need to do, given that they've already had a rollout of these boxes, and they go for, what, 300-400 rand a piece in order to get yourself connected. So just shut down the terrestrial broadcasting network and roll out these boxes to every single person. And the cost of rolling it out to the masses is going to be almost non-existent.
There's more detail in your explanation right now on Cliff Central than in the actual document.
You
can go check it yourself.
Not true. And you see the reason why I'm saying that this is the case is that anyone can actually connect the dots.
But I don't like connect the dot politics, because it's mm-hmm. it leaves so many assumptions open for interpretation, which is what I say everyone gets from the
document. If you do the very specific thing, for example, of the rapid rollout of Spectrum, you're saying that the rapid rollout of Spectrum is not possible.
I'm saying that the document suffers from a lack of detail, because when people read the document, first, they could ask the questions I was asking about, how do you deal with the objections? Is DStv still opposed? Or, number two, how do we then make sure that when you do give Spectrum, more Spectrum to the big four, et cetera, they necessarily are going to reduce the cost or expand the coverage, right? Because their argument has always been, give us more Spectrum, then it's going to be cheap, right? And you've given some of those answers. But now, when we're reading a policy document, you see, the kind of people who read policy documents is not necessarily the listener of a radio station, because we're going to break it down for them, right? It's us. We don't mind the length of the document. If it was a 1,000-page document,
7 pages of it,
we would have gotten a team together. We would have broken it up into digestible parts. Each member of the team would have had to say, this is what it says on education. This is what it says on legal system. This is what it says on immigration. You know, people, they read the Comey report in 2 days. they were ready to speak on it with authority. Mm. So the fact that you could have added document details, right, and you didn't, for me, that's a criticism that I think is fair of a plan that you are bringing to the public for discussion. So now all of the questions I have, right, how am I going to get them? I don't even know if Tito Mboweni's version is his version, right? That's your reading into it and your connecting of the dots. As the guy who's bringing an economic plan for growth, I shouldn't be having to ask a third party what you mean. You should tell me. You had no, it's not an assignment for varsity, this thing, right? There's no word limit. You could have written 100,000 pages if you wanted, and we would have been engaging it and using Google search to find the words, etc., etc. There's ways now to use software to even read very lengthy documents to get the parts of the stuff that you want. Mm. And I feel like this 77 pages for me didn't do enough. That's why I'm happy to call it a discussion document, because we are discussing it. But some of the rhetoric around this is a solid plan, this is the way to go, when some of the elements of the plan haven't been, and these may be the answers, right, which may make me feel more comfortable about it. But as it is now, for me, I was just like, this is a strong C plus.
The thing that, I mean, this very detailed conversation that you have just gone down, this very deep, and it can go on forever, this discussion that you're having, is indicative of what is the major problem we have with the ANC government and with all of the various politicians. I mean, where Tito sits, both in the NEC and as the minister, he has the opportunity to engage each and every single one of the various departments and pull together the team that he needs to implement this. And yet he doesn't do that. And yet he doesn't do that. And then he sends out a thing into the public space. And that's where we are in South Africa. Everybody works in their own little silos. Everybody wants to be the superstar. So Tito now...
Everyone wants to be the savior who brings
Tito up. Now is... He's the... Oh, Tito's discussion document. Tito's plan.
The economic champion.
No, bloody hell. Tito Mboweni is not the savior that we are looking for. We are looking for a government that works together, coherently, to get services to the people.
Now you're getting back to the nub of this discussion, because the question that I asked when I was writing about this stuff is that, you know, yes, you know, you have a framework here that becomes a starting point for things that we can actually use to fix the economy. But is he going to pull it off? No, I'm skeptical. I don't believe that he's even going to get past the starting blocks, because there are just too many vested interests in terms of the ANC right now. And the crucial thing for me is going to be whether Cyril now steps up to the plate and says, yes, the core of the ideas that Tito has given us is what we are going to use to actually take this economy forward and to avoid needing to go and ask the international community for a bailout. And let's actually start working on the framework now of specific ideas, and let's farm these out to the various departments and say, okay, transport, you start working on the breakup of Metro Rail and the breakup of Transnet. Let's hand over the energy policy stuff now to public enterprises and get them to start working on it.
And
is he going to say that, though?
But it's also not just the ANC of today. I mean, I think we're in this misnomer that says, you know, because of a rhetoric around some 10 lost years or whatever it is, it has actually always been the case. Even as we sit here and look at Parliament debating what they're going to do with Mkhwebane and the public protector and those Chapter 9 institutions, suddenly we're realizing that the bedrock of our constitution and these Chapter 9 institutions and the ICASAs, what governs ICASA and how ICASA works and the various departments, it was all built on the best of us. It was built for the best of us. It was built for a Nelson Mandela who was the president. And now suddenly we're realizing that, oh, we didn't think about that. We didn't consider this. And this is what happens with the ANC government, is every single minister comes in and they don't continue with the plans of the past minister. They come in and they have their own legacy projects. Like,
almost reinventing the wheel for no reason.
Oh, no, guys. That's absolutely not true, because William Khiza has come in as Minister of Health and he's taken NHI and he's pushing it. And that was Aaron Motsoaledi's plan from the get-go. No, I think this whole idea... there is continuity. The continuity has always been the National Democratic Revolution. And for the first time right now, what you've got from Tito is something that goes very much against the NDR at a number of levels, because the NDR was always this plot on the part of the ANC to ensure that we have a Chinese-style big state that is actually going to control every aspect of society. So expropriation without compensation ties in directly with that. National health insurance ties in directly with that.
Mm.
The idea that the state is the sole provider of electricity very much ties in with that.
But the ANC has had, let's call it a schizophrenia around their identity, because you've got the tripartite alliance partners, they are more in favor of a command economy style state. However, the NDP and other documents, which they've been very critical of, which were pushed through by Mbeki and subsequently, extended upon by Cyril in commissioning the NDP with Trevor, is that there is continuity, is what I'm saying. There's continuity of this debate within the ANC, because this document that is here is actually, it's, some people have called it a remix of all of the old, Akisa, Kia, and now NDP, and now there's this Tito remix. So they're saying this is a rhythm. It's not necessarily a new song. But there's that tension. So you're right that there's continuity within the ANC, but let's call it factional continuity. My criticism, though, of the ANC, if I were to bring it down into a one-liner, is that actually the focus is misplaced. And I'll tell you why. When you go to successful communities around the world, even in South Africa, the first thing that you've got to fix is education, right? You've almost got to make sure that you get that right, because it is a multifactorial thing that affects more than one situation. So one, you're not going to be economically competitive if your people are not well educated, right? But two, you don't deal with the social ills that manifest if you don't provide your people with the right education. So this patriarchy, this misogyny that we are seeing, this culture of violence, it's also a symptom of a poor education system, because it basically means that our kids were in a situation for 12 years where they were supposed to be getting moral and technical leadership, mm-hmm. right? But they got zero. And it doesn't have to be a religious morality or anything like that. Just things like, listen, a man thinking that he's better than a woman is wrong. A man thinking that he's entitled to a woman's body is wrong. You know, at the
and
private
none of
schools,
that puts food on our table. None
no,
of
I mean,
that,
but you need both.
No.
I'll tell you why you need both. Let me tell you why.
Education, which you raise as an example, is a 20-year project. So if you start fixing education at early childhood development now, you'll see the first results in 20 years.
But
time,
I'll
which
push
is not,
back on that.
Which is not to say that it doesn't need to happen. It does need
I'll
to happen.
I'll push back on that. And okay, I'd give you the case study of the Harlem schools, where this guy comes in and he starts reinventing education, and he's working with what he has. So some people just need remedial classes to catch up to where they need to be. So I would actually say it's a 4 or 5 year project. If you get a grade 8 and you get them to catch up, because they're still smart, they just were poorly taught by previous.
They cannot read, write, and count in grade 8. You have lost the plot already.
But that's the thing. That's where I'm saying that this is the mistake of the premise. Even in the ANC administration, by just saying, and this is in the document Tito wrote, that we're just going to focus on early childhood development. You can save a grade 8, even one who is seemingly a lost cause, because if they are sharp, and many of them are, right, they want to learn, they're desperate to learn. And if you've been in a township school, you know those characters, you know they're smart, you can tell that they're struggling with content, but they don't have the rest of the system to salvage that. But I wanted to say something about why the social education is as important as the technical education. If you breed through inactivity a violent community, then you actually affect adversely your investment opportunities, because who wants to go to an unsafe country? And then you create the kind of ills we're seeing socially, like xenophobia, because now you have to try to educate somebody on social media that, hey, these very Nigerians that you're attacking spent billions when their currency was still quite strong to help Mandela fight for the freedom that you're enjoying. Which is not to say that they are entitled to sell drugs, but it's to say that how you look at the average Nigerian,
the Nigerians
should be different.
The Nigerians never were part of the funding structure of the ANC.
No, they were actually. Not of the ANC, of the movement, right? And there's many articles that are actually now on social media showing that there was a Nigerian commitment. They gave South African activists passports along with Ghana, along with the frontier states. There was a coordinated effort under Kwame Nkrumah to help you know, a lot of the states to get free. And it was continued even after he was removed. So my point is simply this, without getting too much into the details, is that if you don't provide the social education which is necessary to facilitate the statecraft, because, you know, it's not just about having engineers. You know, you also need to have engineers in a conducive society where we're not going to stone them, et cetera, because we're resentful. We need to have, in fact, if you look across democracies now, there's a failure of discourse because we haven't taught people how to engage in rational conversations. Mm. Like if we were in parliament right now, the level of conversation we've had, we may vote differently at the end of the issue, but we've been able to work through and understand each other's thinking. Right now, you spread that to a public, then you remove xenophobia, you remove misogyny, patriarchy. Some of the manifestations of social ills we're seeing right now stem from failures in the classroom. Right. So what I'm saying is, and this is the point I've been trying to make, is that it seems to me that the ANC government is always resetting on education. It's resetting, resetting, resetting. When Cyril was in Japan, they told him, fix your education. The Economist almost once a year publishes an education special just on South Africa saying, fix your education. Our education is notoriously behind any of the other G20 countries and anybody else who we are saying that we want to compete with. So I would actually have preferred if Cyril had come through and said, my main priority in my first 2 years of office is to, obviously the state-owned enterprises are in collapse. That is a ICU situation. But in the general ward, I would have preferred for him to say, our main priority is going to be education and fixing the classrooms so that we really are globally competitive, so that we salvage those grade eights who can be salvaged. Because right now we are sitting on 25% can go to university and the 75% are not able to. They go to the TVETs, but the TVETs have a 12% pass rate. Mm. Do you understand? So 25% go to university. Of that 25%, only 15% graduates. The 75%, not really 75%, but the remainder who go to the TVETs are going into a situation where the institutions themselves are so bad, there's less than a 10% in some of them pass rate. So you're actually saying to young people, I'm writing you off as the administration. Good luck. We can't have an administration that does that. And for me, that's why education is the apex priority of this administration. Unfortunately, that's not what's being communicated.
Yeah.
Governing reluctantly with his strong mandate. That's what Cyril is doing.
We could have gotten into so much more this morning. Really, this was unpacking a lot. And look, the week we have, this is all necessary. Actually, just before we wrap up the color ads, to our point earlier around some of the points that were raised in Project Tito, color says, guys, I had a meeting with some international transport people as well as a Transnet rep. All I can say is I'm extremely positive about the actions being taken by Transnet. They're looking at a availing assets, increasing exports, and through that, creating jobs and stimulating the economy. They are partnering with global powerhouses and local specialists through smart and very capable representatives. Go, Cyril, he says.
Well, just on the specific point with regard to Transnet, remember that during the height of the colonial era and then even into the apartheid era, pretty much up until 1974, mm-hmm. we had a situation where you could get onto a train in Durban and catch a train on a daily basis up to Salisbury, which was Harare.
Mm-hmm.
This was
on a daily basis.
On a daily basis.
Available, the facilities.
Yeah, daily basis. You know, you'd walk into the Durban station and there'd be the train that was leaving for Salisbury. Mm-hmm. You could catch a train from Durban across to Maputo. You could catch trains multiple times per day going from Johannesburg to Maputo. Of course, Lorenzo Marx back in the day. Now, the railway line is actually interrupted when you get to the border. And the very simple process of saying, let's just start by joining those railway lines, and then you license operators to actually run along those railway lines. And that's immediately going to open up this whole idea of the African free trade area, which becomes the way in which we actually exercise our competitive advantage with the rest of the subcontinent. Because if you cannot freely move your goods, we spoke about this with regard to the chaos on the N3. Because remember, I said there, a lot of those trucks that leave Durban Harbour, they're actually heading up to Dar es Salaam. They drive nonstop. They pick up the containers in Durban and they drive up to Dar es Salaam. It's a 24-hour nonstop journey. They're basically changing drivers along the way. And that's how goods is currently moving. But it's hugely inefficient.
And rail infrastructure would actually also save our roads and also save our roads. So less potholes.
And so that, just that very simple thing, if Tito is able to get only that thing off the ground.
Imagine and look at the impact.
Yes, look at the impact. Yeah. So yes, it's low on detail, but it starts with simple things. It's fixing the broken windows.
But you've already said like it's dead in the water now because he failed to land the plane.
It's dead in the water because he's not going to be able to get it past Cyril.
I think also because of the way he did it. He just didn't strategize the launch.
I know it's the only way that he was able to do it, because if he had, remember that immediately Kosatu climbed into him and said, how dare you release this without first bouncing it past us? No, he had to do it this way. Because otherwise, it would never have seen the light of day because of the way in which the ANC works. So what he's essentially doing, Tito, is he's throwing down a gauntlet because he knows right now that Cyril cannot actually afford to fire him at this point. Because
why do you say that?
If Tito gets fired, okay, former governor of the Reserve Bank, impeccable credentials, okay, former board member of Goldman Sachs, again, impeccable credentials, unrolls an economic plan, and then Cyril fires him. You know what happens? What happens to the rand? What happens to the credit rating? So Tito has basically seized an opportunity to say, "I'm putting this out here. Now engage with this."
But does Tito even believe this stuff? Because his tweets were so socialist before he got the job, and now he's back on the job. He's so pro-capital.
Tito is fundamentally socialist, but Tito understood from the time that he was in the Reserve Bank, that the way in which you actually make this country prosperous is to do exactly what Mbeki did during his era, which was he turned the economy loose. He had unprecedented profits that raked back in the form of taxes. And what did he do with those taxes? The first thing he did was to pay off the national debt. And after he'd paid off the national debt, the money that was saved that was no longer going towards paying off the national debt, he put into social grants. And the immediate impact of that was the single biggest upliftment of people out of poverty that has happened in history, anywhere on the planet.
You know, I think to close off from my side, I would say I'd be happy to live in a neoliberal economy if everyone had the right educational opportunities to compete. Because right now, it's not like that. So I would be happy to sign off anything Tito Mboweni puts off from a free market side if the same level of commitment and intensity and detail was given to fixing the classroom. Because otherwise, then you have the spoils of the economy just going to Sandton and, you know, surrounding areas and not extending to Soweto. Because guess what? You couldn't even get the degree in finance because you were set up to fail from the jump. So I think if that document sees a different reiteration where it's just dropped in the middle of the night like this one was, it for me would have to have sufficient levels of detail on the education side, the policy protection so that we don't get the worst capitalists, and then maybe I'll reflect on it more positively. But the way I looked at it, I think I still put a question mark around the document just in terms of it seems incomplete to me.
There we go. Yeah, we have to wrap up. We've even gone a little over 8 right now. So, Swimmy, thank you so much. I hope you're feeling better by next week. We've got to keep on keeping on, man.
I'm not here next week.
Ah, halala. Must be nice. See? She's people living their best lives.
Hanging so out. You will be feeling better.
Hanging out with 6 brown chicks is what she's doing.
That's what she'll be doing. Kanten, thank you so much. Have an awesome week.
Loads of fun. Yes. Thanks, guys.
And Jamie, thank you so much for stopping by.
It was a pleasure.
At Mighty Jamie on Twitter if you want to keep up with him and hear more of his views. But definitely,
follow him.
Yeah. Give a follow, give a like, give a all of those things. And thank you for listening as well. You're having us on cliffcentral.com. Look, Gareth will be back on Monday morning. And as I did say yesterday, he recorded some key interviews that we are rolling out this week, including an interview right now that he recorded with Stephen Malharba. And Stephen is a founder and chief executive of Genesis Analytics, which is the largest economics-based consultancy in Africa. So this is quite an interesting conversation to have parallel to the World Economic Forum Africa currently taking place. So take a listen to this as I have a conversation around the fourth industrial revolution. This is cliffcentral.com.
This is cliffcentral.com.